Blog Talk Radio.
Agreed to come back to our show to answer questions from our host that we didn't get to ask on his previous visit. Of course, we're talking about his very popular aviation mystery novel, Flying Too Close to the Sun. We can tell you it's not your average whodunit mystery. This book has it all. Airplanes, airports, employees, air shuttle, sex, popular settings in the northeastern cities, and much, much more. Tonight's show, our hosts have picked their own topics of interest they want to share with you. Let me introduce the host for tonight's show. From Jacksonville area are Margaret Bars and Neil Holland. How are you folks this evening?
Hey, Jim. Well, after a weekend of heavy thunderstorms, we've had a beautiful sunny day here with a temperature somewhere around 65. But they tell us tonight we're going to experience near record low temperature, dipping down to about 35. And the moon phase is waxing gibbous. Do you or any of our hosts know what that means?
I don't.
But
I don't.
Margaret has said it all.
And I don't.
Well, Margaret, you better tell us what it means.
Well, waxing means increasing rather than waning, which means decreasing. And actually, gibbous, it simply means, and actually in medical terms, it was called hunchback. And so the moon is actually increasing
crescent.
The extent of the illumination portion before the full moon. So it's a crescent moon tonight.
Okay, very good. Well, for my part, Jim, I just wanted to say that anyone that wants to read a wonderful book, Flying Too Close to the Sun, you can go to Amazon.com and type in George Jen, his name, and that book will pop up, and you can order it for a fabulous price of $10.95. Really cheap entertainment, and it'll really entertain you. So Amazon.com is George Jen, and the last name is J-E-H-N. Back to you, Jim.
Thank you, Neil. From Delray Beach, Florida, we have Jan Bushkai. Hi, Jan. How are things down in Delray?
They're absolutely marvelous, Jim. Unfortunately, today there was a brush fire behind my house in a vacant piece of land, which made quite a stir in the neighborhood. We had fire department and police and all sorts of people, but the Delray activity downtown is still live and well. And they're waiting for people to show up for the Delray Affair, which will take place the weekend after Easter. So please plan to look that up on the internet and enjoy all of the art and the crafts that are being offered, as well as the food and the drink.
Thanks, Jan. And now from the villages up in the northern part of the state of Florida, where I'm going to be in my 8th Air Force reunion on May 11, 12, and 13, we have Chuck Albright. Hi, Chuck. How are things up there?
Well, we're doing pretty good tonight. As my fellow people have already stated, we had a wonderful day, beautiful weather, stayed cool, woke up to a balmy 47 degrees, and worked its way up to about 71 today. As before, as we were talking with the other folks, it's going to drop down pretty cool, but not as cool as them. Looks like we're going to drop into probably the low 40s, but that's not going to stop our golf game. Tomorrow is our golf tournament. In fact, I'm scheduled to take part in two of the tournaments tomorrow, so I'm hoping that we'll have the cool weather will kind of shift on over and keep us guys on the golf course, and the girls, they have their tournament too, and have a nice day tomorrow. So why don't we just turn it back to you?
Okay, thank you very much, Chuck. And from Roaring Gap, North Carolina, Steve Thompson. Steve, how's everything up there in the Carolina Mountains?
Well, Jim, old man winter has way overstayed his welcome. And we woke up this morning to about 2 inches of snow that covered everything. And the high today has been 32 degrees with about a steady 25 to 35 knot wind all day. Forecast to be the same thing throughout the rest of the week. We're tired of it, and we want to get the spring weather here as quick as possible.
Bill Joseph, a regular host on our show, is in transition from Grand Junction, Colorado, to Newport Richey, Florida. He'll be back with us as soon as his move is complete. Hurry back, Bill. We miss you.
Of all the ways that we can fly, of all the highways to the sky, of all the wings that greet the sun,
passengers have flown Eastern than any other airline in the free world. If you've helped make us America's favorite way to fly, we thank you. If you haven't flown Eastern recently, give us a try. We'll show you we really do earn our wings every day.
To get started with their comments or stories for this week. Remember, we might want to question you or add comments of our own after your topic. Go ahead, please, Margaret.
Hey, Jim. I would like to start, if that's okay. Now, my subject is fear of flying. And flying is something that most people take for granted. You know, the ability to book a plane ticket, board the flight, and enjoy a vacation without being plagued by a fear of flying. But for many of us, we cannot do those things. And without getting too technical, that's what fear of flying is. It's an anxiety disorder. And despite statistics that tell us flying is one of the safest modes of travel, many of us will only fly if we have to. And others are so afraid of flying, they'll never travel by air at all. And I will admit, I do have anxiety.
Margaret, I thought that's why they put liquor kits on airplanes.
Yes, that may be true, Neil, but if you recall, I am one of those few people who is allergic to alcohol. I have to go through life sober,
okay.
And I have to get on the plane sober and leave sober.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Sounds anyway,
like state to me.
Yes, hey, Chuck. Oh, I thought you had a comment. Anyway, I was just going to say, you know, I'll actually drive 12 and a half hours to visit my family in Kentucky because I would rather do that than get on a plane. And I'm not alone in that. Actually, there's quite a few notable people with a fear of flying. Just to mention a few, Doris Day, Whoopi Goldberg, Stanley Kubrick, and Randy Rhoads, and John Madden. So there are a few of us out there. And there was actually a study commissioned by Boeing Company, and they wanted to, you know, try to determine the impact of the fear of flying in the U.S. travel industry. And here's some of the interesting statistics they came up with, and I thought this was interesting. 18.1% of the adults in the United States are afraid to fly. And there's another 12.6% who experience anxiety once they do get on the planes. So if you add those two together, in short, you can pretty much say one out of three adult Americans are actually afraid to fly. So here's the question I have for you, Captain Neil, and some of the hosts. In the past, many airlines did offer their own fear of flying programs, and I believe Pan Am was said to have been the first, and starting somewhere, I believe, back in 1975. And then, of course, American Airlines, U.S. Airways, and Northwest Airlines with their Wings program also. And I do not want to leave out British Airways. They did as well. So my first question is this. Did Eastern ever offer any of those programs for those of us afraid to fly?
Jim?
No, I don't know of any that came out of the home office at all, except the games that I was playing one time. I think I mentioned before in a previous program that I used to be what they called a flying cruise director. I was playing bingo on board our DC-8 aircraft for about a three-month period on a trial basis to help relax the people on board. That was one of the reasons. That wasn't really advertised that much. The only way that people knew that we had such a program was when they arrived at the airport. My airport was Boston. When they got there, they found not only an area that was geared to the actual flyer, but for all the people that were seeing them off, they had punch and cookies and me to discuss how things were going to go on the flight. That's the only thing that I remembered, and that was all my years with Eastern.
Well, you know, one of the things that I can say contributed to people's fear of flying, as you recall, for years and years, we had insurance booths, kiosks, or whatever you want to call them, up and down the corridors, insuring your life on that trip.
That's true.
I remember those in Miami International Airport.
That's almost like saying, are you sure you want to be on this flight today?
Golly. I'm telling you. You know, one of the things I might interject here is they didn't have a fear of flying. I recall that Eastern was involved with some of the, like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and some of the other children's programs that they allowed the children to take a flight around the Miami area.
Right.
Does anybody ever remember that?
Yes, I do recall that type of thing. And we also had tours so that they could go up into the cockpit, and that was well before the various things that happened security-wise. But they would allow children to go into the cockpit, and perhaps some of the pilots recall that sort of thing. That very much reminds me of bingo, as Jim mentioned. It was to ease people and ease the children and the adults as well to actually keep them involved so that they didn't think about what they were actually doing.
Yeah.
So that's my thought on it.
Well, that's great. You know, again, liquor kits make sense to me. But we can go on. We can have a 1-hour show on just nothing but the fear of flying. But we've got a lot more. One more, Margaret.
Well, I do have one more question, if you don't mind. Did any of you as captains ever have anyone on the airplane, on your airplane, that just sort of went berserk because they were afraid of being on that plane?
Steve, I
don't recall anyone.
Well, I had two of them. One was when I was flying the Convair, and fortunately we were on the ground. and a person challenged the captain. I was a co-pilot, brand new co-pilot. The captain, person got on the airplane and challenged the captain that he was going to go on that trip without a ticket. So that's one. And we had one en route. I was flying a 727 as captain at that time. And we had it wasn't really a threat as much as it was a person that went kind of nuts, and I think she was. But she was up and down the aisle preaching to the first class. She started in first class preaching to them about the need for salvation and that type of thing. Had her Bible, and then the flight attendant came up to me and told me about the disturbance in the back because she was going through the cabin, and it was a stretch 727, a long airplane. And she came up to me and said, "You got to do something about this." So I put on my hat and coat, went back,
authority.
That's the word I'm looking for. And she told me, she said, "You are the devil." And that's the way, black uniform and all. And so we had a few words, and we got her. Finally, we got seated, and that was that wasn't really a big threat to the airplane.
And it got that liquor kit out.
Yeah.
I would like to share something. My father, when I was approximately 7 to 10 years old, wanted to take the family to Buenos Aires to visit his brother, and he wanted to go with the whole family. So he wanted to, make sure everybody was cool with that. And I had a fear of flying at the time, and it was the first time in my life that I got my way. And, of course, the family did not go because I was literally shaking and absolutely tears were just pouring out. And I said, I absolutely will not get on an airplane. And here I was over 33 years with Eastern Airlines, never had a fear of flying during my entire career.
Wow.
Okay. Okay. Chuck, I think you're next up to bat.
Now, my subject tonight is a little technical since I'm the mechanic of the group here. And it what it lends itself to is, why is the plane delayed, or why is the flight canceled? And one of the reasons was that the L-1011 TriStar jet that Eastern was so proud of came out with Rolls-Royce RB211 engines. And unfortunately for us at Eastern, these engines were a new type of engines where they had three drive shafts in them. Normally the engines have two drive shafts in them. And they had a lot of new stuff on them. And one of the things that they had is the big fan in the engine that you see when you're looking at the engine from the outside of the airplane is it's all attached to a hub. And that hub, at that particular time, they thought would be a great idea to save money and weight, was instead of making it out of metal, they would make it out of a composite type of material. And it worked great as long as the engine ran, because the blades were centrifugally locked into place into this, we called it phenolic. But unfortunately, when the engine is sitting on the ground and the wind is blowing and it just keeps rotating the engines, it doesn't have that centrifugal force to hold the blades in tight, and it would literally wobble the slots that these blades were in. So when you were told that the plane was going to be delayed or you were going to lose your flight altogether, a lot of times it was because this RB211 engine failed. It was either because of this fan problem. A couple of other problems they had was an oil problem. Sometimes the oil wouldn't be right in the engines, and they would freeze the engines up. Sometimes some of the engines got so hot that the inside of the engines would actually get hot and fail. So that's one of the things that we had to put up with at Eastern Airlines with the new, brand new L-1011 airplane. Fortunately for Progress at Derby, England, where the engines are made, they went ahead and kept trying to improve the engine. But unfortunately, the RB211 engine division was went bankrupt, and of course the English government bailed them out for a while until they got back on their feet. Today they build a beautiful engine. It's called a Trent engine, and they have very little or no problems whatsoever out of it. So that is why some degree that when you were sitting there looking out the window and you saw this big fan on this big jet just going around, that contributed sometime later on, maybe not for you, but somebody else had a delay or a canceled flight. Anybody
Steve,
got a question?
Yeah, Steve, you probably remember like me having flown the 1011. Golly, if I didn't hear the clink clanking of those little old blades as the engine turned static at the ramp, I thought that the engine was missing.
Yeah, I remember that so well. But I loved that engine. I loved it.
I did too.
As long as it had oil in it.
And as long as you
if it functioned correctly, it was a great engine. Unfortunately, we would put an engine on out of the engine shop. I was the manager in the engine shop at Eastern for a while. And we would put an engine out of the shop, put it on the airplane, test it, do the static test on it and everything, and it would check fine. And they would fly from Miami to New York, and by the time it got to New York, the New York mechanics would take that engine off and put another one on. It was a real headache for maintenance and a real financial problem for not only Rolls-Royce, but Eastern took a big hit back then on that engine. But fortunately, they come around with this Trent engine, and it's really great. Anybody else?
I have a question about the RB211.
Go ahead.
And I think I know the answer to this, but why did we have a three-engine or three-minute warm-up time from the time the engine started till the time we could apply takeoff power?
The engine was a tri-spool engine. I don't know if you know anything about building engines, but what it was is you had to, they wanted the oil temperature to be at a certain temperature before you guys applied the full takeoff power to these engines. Now a lot of times, I've seen them, and I don't know how you guys were told to, but I've actually seen planes taxi on out and go on and take their takeoff. I can't really answer your question fully. I know that we had oil problems, and maybe on that note, they wanted the oil to be at a certain temperature when you took off, and that's why you had the delay.
That must have been Captain Slim Cox taking off without any warm-up.
Yeah.
I would never forget his instructions to the co-pilots on flaring that airplane, and he would say, wear it like a bow tie, meaning the yoke, put it right back in your neck and do a two-point landing, you know, and he was
mm-hmm.
something else. Okay. Yeah, we got, let's see, frequent flyer miles. I think Jan is your subject.
Frequent flyer miles. Pardon?
Yes. Yes, frequent flyer miles.
Okay. The very first modern frequent flyer program was created in 1972 by Western Direct Marketing, and that was for United Airlines. They gave plaques and promotional materials to members. And then in 1979, Texas International, which I have always known as TI, created the first frequent flyer program that used mileage tracking to give rewards to its passengers. However, it all started, as we know it, when American Airlines introduced a program called AA Advantage. And that was in 1979, I believe, 1981, American started the program. And that was a modification, and it was primarily introduced and developed as an incentive to reward the repeated customers. Americans, it was quickly followed later that year by programs from United Airlines, Mileage Plus, Delta Airlines called SkyMiles, and including British Airways, they called it Executive Club. Does anyone know what the name of the Eastern program was? Does anybody recall that? It was known as OnePass.
OnePass,
and
yeah.
Yes, and that was developed in the early 80s. And it's very interesting to bring this full circle. What has happened, the intent of the program, I don't know if anybody has tried to use their American Express mileage for a particular location as I did in going to Hawaii. And I had a schedule picked out that wasn't as long as most. And American did not partner with those particular airlines. So I would have had to use just a phenomenal amount of mileage to even travel free, so to speak. And now you can even pay to, if they don't have space on board, they allot an X number of seats for frequent travelers. Now you can actually pay more money and they'll accommodate you. But I found one thing that was very interesting. There was an article that I read in the Wall Street Journal that spoke about Arcello's people also. And musicians are trying to bring their cellos on board. Hmm. And one gentleman who had his cello, he paid for the seat. And the question becomes whether the cello can receive frequent traveler miles. And the airline in question said absolutely not. So I was wondering, has anybody had an experience of that sort in trying to bring a pet or an instrument on board?
No, I don't guess they'd get a meal either, Jan.
No, probably. That's
cello,
true.
Right?
I think they'd get a drink either.
No,
Does anybody have any questions? I have a couple questions.
I have a remark. I was going to give a little trivia about frequent flyer, but you have already mentioned that Delta's the name of their program was SkyMiles and United Mileage Plus, and then of course AAdvantage American Airlines. But can you tell me who used the frequent flyer program known as TrueBlue?
JetBlue.
Okay, that's the dead giveaway, isn't it? How about Dividend Miles? Who used Dividend Miles?
Dividend Miles is it was U.S. Airways.
Golly, you're good, Jan. Okay. How about
and your homework?
How about Rapid Rewards?
Rapid Rewards. I can't think of who did that one. I'm
the only other airline, the big airline. What's the other, only big airline that we haven't mentioned? The one
United.
That
no, Delta.
Delta. We mentioned United. We mentioned a lot of them, but the one that is out of Texas.
Continental.
Frontier.
How about Southwest?
Southwest.
Okay.
I just have something to tell you about frequent traveler miles, which, as we've discussed, have all different names nowadays. But I had some lingering United Airlines frequent traveler miles. So they sent me a very nice letter to say, you know, I had a choice of this, this, or that, or some magazines. Well, I selected magazines. The number of magazines that came into my house, it's unbelievable. I couldn't even catch up on reading, so it was kind of a waste, and I sent them a letter to say, you know, please cancel me. Yeah. But for anybody who selects magazines, at least in my experience, I strongly would recommend selecting something more useful than magazines would be.
Or at least from Publisher's Clearinghouse.
There you go.
Exactly.
Jan, this is Chuck.
Exactly.
I got a question. If you use your frequent flyer miles and you get a free trip, do you still have to pay for all the other things that you get charged for, like bags and where you're sitting and things of that sort that they charge for today?
I personally have not had that experience, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if, you know, you get certain perks if you are a frequent traveler, such as you can board ahead. But I don't know if they offer that to everybody because I only have traveled with a few carriers, such as American, JetBlue, and a few others. Does anybody know the answer to that?
No, but Jan, you had to travel between Florida and I think Chicago frequently while you were in charge of an estate up there, I believe. What airline did you use then?
I first used United, and then when they stopped serving Fort Lauderdale, because I find that's my preferred airport from where I live in Delray, I now am flying American Airlines. So I use American.
Okay, let's move on to our next subject. Steve, what you got?
Yes, Neil. Mine is Colonial Airlines, and they held just a real fascination for me because they came with a different culture than I was associated, that I'd ever been associated with since my first airline was Piedmont Airlines, and then, of course, Eastern Airlines. And Colonial, the merger had certainly already occurred when I came to work for Eastern. And the airline operated for a period of about 5 years, during which a fierce competition was fought for its control between Eastern and National Airlines. And then after several reversals of government policy, Eastern emerged as the acquirer, and the operational merger took place on 1st of June in 1956. And Colonial Airlines brought to Eastern a company that gave us Canada, the Northern Division, Bermuda, as well as a marvelous group of pilots and flight attendants. I had the opportunity of spending a couple of winters flying into Malone, Messina, Saranac Lake, Rutland, Burlington, Wilkes-Barre, Glens Falls, and Syracuse with many of the old Colonial captains. And that was the finest training in short field operations, foul weather flying, snow and ice, and we had to make ADF approaches, NDB approaches, and VR approaches. And that was the finest training that any young 22-year-old co-pilot like myself could hope for.
Good vacation.
And after a winter in the Northern Division, we were truly instrument pilots.
Yeah.
I also remember some of the colorful characters among the Colonial pilots. And I'd like to hear from any of you all or our listeners who had a chance to fly these routes and can recall some of those colorful Colonial pilots.
Steve, I believe Ernie Gann in one of his books wrote a story about that. And I think before I became a pilot, I remember reading that book and about the DC-3 flying in those areas that you mentioned. And it was considered really one of the people just didn't like to fly those routes. And obviously, for the reasons that you mentioned, and I did fly into Wilkes-Barre and some of those Binghamton and Syracuse, of course, there. But that was a large airport. But I did get a little winterization, I guess we'd call it, as a pilot, and it really improves your flying abilities. But also, you mentioned that I think Colonial was started in 47, somewhere around there, because they were issued the very first foreign airmail contract, and that was up to Canada. Of course, they started out as Canadian Colonial Airlines, and the award that they got from issuing authority was FAM-1. That was the airmail, federal airmail, and number one contract. So they were the very first to be awarded a foreign carrier operation as far as airmail is concerned. But interesting. And, yeah, you're right. There's some real interesting people that were with the Colonial, some good friends like Al Breelaud, and we've had Whitey John on the show before. Of course, Whitey was in the Czech Airmen's department down in Miami, and I had the pleasure of going through a check ride with him. But they had some great great pilots, too.
They really did, yes. It was just a fun group to work with. It was just, and it was in an area that I had never, I hadn't even heard about it. And here I am, this young co-pilot that's based in New York, and I'm getting to fly into these airports that were just so interesting, intriguing to me.
Did you ever
and a
land
challenge at, also?
Yeah.
Did you ever land at Bradley?
Oh yes, oh. Yes, many times.
Sure, absolutely.
It was at that time in the early mid 50s that we were selling tickets over a milk crate or milk carton across the airport from where the present terminal is. There was a terminal over there that was used by Flying Tiger, and that's when Eastern first went up that way.
Yeah. Well, let's move on here. I think my subject is next, but I'm going to shorten it down because of time. These are good subjects you guys have selected. Mine is about a character, or not a character, but an individual in management with Eastern. And his joining Eastern Airlines was back in 1928. So he was one of the initial employees of Eastern Airlines. Well, in that time it was Pitt Caron and then Eastern Air Transport. But he was the first dispatcher that was hired for dispatching aircraft with Eastern. And he was based up at LaGuardia, and he had some interesting comments on a 20 years of progress report that Eddie Rickenbacker had some of the select key personnel to write about what Eastern had done, what it meant, Eastern meant to them in their time with the company for those 20 years, and it was given in 1948. And some of the interesting things that Norman Scully, who is a person I'm talking about, a dispatcher, as a matter of fact, he was superintendent of dispatching, and he foresaw in the future some of the things that I just wanted to mention here. But before I mention these, he was forecasting or prophesizing. He said that Eastern Airlines is not one man's company. It has attached its place in the air transportation business today because it is a product of many men's work, loyalty, and initiative. It is the cooperation of all employees in all departments that makes the company great, and that creates a feeling of I am working for my company, not for some completely impersonal organization. And so that kind of stuck out for me when I was reading this little thing here. But he forecasted in place of the present radial engine or inline gasoline conventional engine, there will be propeller jet powered aircraft by 1955. I think that was about the time the electric came on to the property. And he also said that turbojet propulsion by 1968 or 1970, I guess he means the turbine engine. Rocket power will have made such progress that coast-to-coast flights will be made under 4 hours with possibly one stop en route. He also said that aircraft will be manufactured carrying 80 to 100 passengers in domestic operations, saying also that transocean flying boats that would carry from 500 to 1,000 passengers. He mentioned that the airways will be electronic airways instead of taking your old computer and computing for wind triangulation, and that electronic flight control that will give one dispatch office for the complete Eastern Airlines system a visual picture by push-button control of the exact position of any of our aircraft at any given moment, and the development of distance measuring equipment that instantly will give a pilot his exact distance and any given selected point. Development of through chemicals of satisfactory fog dispersal techniques at airports. And finally, the development of all of the above will permit all-weather flying, which is essential for dependability of schedules. I think he was correct in just about every one of those.
He was a visionary.
Wasn't he, though? I don't think you knew him, did you, Jim?
No, I did not know Norm Scully.
Jan, you didn't know Norm Scully either, did you? Okay.
Well, he didn't get rid of the fog.
No, as a matter of fact, they did some seating out at Salt Lake. I remember flying into Salt Lake, and they had a Cessna 310 that would fly down the runway and dropping little pellets and dispersing so the fog would lift. Do you remember that, Steve?
I do remember that, absolutely.
Jan, I'm sorry I cut you off there. Did you have something to say there?
No, I don't. And
was that the seeding? Is that the dry ice that they dropped?
Yeah.
Yes.
Chemical mixture of that and other things, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But, Jim, what's your subject here tonight?
Well, you know, I remembered, of course, unfortunately, I was manager of passenger relations in New York, and we got word of a program. I think it was on television from either NBC or CBS, where they were going to depict a person on an airplane who actually hijacked the airplane. Eastern tried to get that program knocked off the air for fear of what would happen in the future, and sure enough, there it happened. But we heard of so many hijackings, but I don't think we heard about the end result. And it appeared at that time that Cuba was a favorite hijacked to location. And I'm wondering, do any of you know what the end result was on some of those? Did the hijacker get arrested, or did he get away free of charge, or what?
Well, being from Miami, we would get the underground, so to speak, from the Hispanic community there. At first, they were kind of brought into the country, and they weren't popular, but they accomplished their mission, because sometimes they brought the airplane in, and whatever it cost to fuel the plane and everything else, the Cuban government would obviously charge you for, and probably overcharge you for the fuel. But later on, I think the United States and Cuba had an agreement that they would return the hijacker back to the United States. That's why it became, in my opinion, it became an unpopular feat for these people to do. Plus the security things that came along in the years down in that area. Now, we have seen the hijackings overseas and in the Far East and Middle Eastern states that sometimes were very tragic. But I think just the culmination of what we do today to prevent hijackings is really, I guess, something that's caused the decline of hijackings here in the United States.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well. There has been a definite decline in incidents, and I was thinking back to all of the things that the industry has tried to do to make it safer, of course, for captain and crew. Such as, I think they beefed up the cabin door, and of course they would not open the cabin door. At one time, I guess, the flight attendants were able to just go in and ask the captain, the crew, if what they would like maybe for a meal. But I think that was all changed. I'm not sure of what changes were made in that area. Neil, probably you or one of the other members, say Steve, might add to it.
Yeah, I don't know of any changes except that there were certain signals that that you would agree to with the between the flight attendants and the pilots, and the intercom was used instead of knocking on the door, which was a popular way of the flight attendants asking to be admitted to the cockpit. Primarily, the intercom system was used mostly to communicate.
Yeah.
I wonder if when they started to put air marshals on the flights, that had to be a definite deterrent. Did anyone get that feeling?
And also the arming of the pilots at their discretion, that was also pretty widely dispersed, the idea that the pilot might be armed.
Did you carry a
weapon, I think that
Steve?
Had a deterrent.
Did
Sir?
You carry a weapon?
No, I did not. No, that was not a part of the program when I was flying.
Well, how about you, Neil?
My son does.
Yeah. Well, I never did either, Steve, but one of the clipboards, the clipboard was our, you know, it was that metal clipboard that we had, and that would really hurt somebody if you used it. And, of course, my flight bag, of course, it was heavy enough to put somebody down. But, no, I never did. I remember Bill Malone used to carry his, and there was a joke around, of course, about Bill and his revolver that he carried in his flight bag. But I won't tell that over the air.
There's a question for anybody.
Was the revolver allowed in those days?
Yeah. Yeah, we were given permission that we could carry a weapon. And they are doing it now. Do you say your son does it, Steve?
Yes. You have to go through a training program.
Does anybody know which airline allowed to have a military person with a, I guess it was a machine gun, that's in a compartment between the cockpit and the first class section? Was it Russia or Israel?
Mm-mm. Both,
I
probably. We're running out of time here, folks, so we're going to go right straight to Jim. We're not going to take a commercial break.
Okay, very good. Wow, what a variety of subjects this evening. Let's go on to our second round of subjects open for discussion. Margaret, I think you're up.
I am, Jim, and I just wanted to quickly comment on the Transportation Security Administration, better known as TSA, allowing people with criminal records to get airport security badges. Now, according to a recent Air Nation article just dated recently, March 11th, in a report from the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General, the agency addressed the bungling of an airport security badge vetting program, which allowed at least 11 individuals with criminal backgrounds to obtain access to secured airport areas. And what's more disconcerting is that some of these individuals with criminal records may actually retain such access to this day. And it went on to say that TSA did not have a written comprehensive plan for the project design and implementation and had very little documentation on the project at all, and none about who made or even approved those project decisions. And this is interesting. The project team supposedly made decisions, but no one can prove what they were because TSA did not maintain team meeting minutes but relied on agendas as evidence of actions assigned to each responsible member of the team. And just very quickly, Marsha Blackburn, congressman from Tennessee, just highlighted a few of the cases of criminal activity. Apparently, 15 cases involved the theft of airline passengers' possessions, There was child pornography charges, sex crimes, about 14 incidents of that, 5 incidents of assault. 3 employees were arrested for bribery. There was crimes involving drugs and illegal firearms. And moreover, she went on to say, if the TSA was really serious about having the best workforce available, it would not recruit new employees by placing ads on pizza boxes and gas pumps as it did in the D.C. area. And it would consistently conduct criminal and credit background checks on new and existing employees.
Well, I have a couple of songs I was going to play, but because of the time, I'm going to just do that at another time. We can have a show on TSA also. Chuck, how about your next subject? And just keep it as brief as you can because of time.
Okay, I'm going to cut mine down a little bit. And my subject was the maintenance problems after Eastern purchased the Airbus A300. Airbus Industries is a airline in Toulouse, France. And what they did was they put a plane together. They would get different ideas from different companies, and they actually tinker-toyed their first Airbus together. You would have cargo doors and flaps made by Kawasaki Motorcycle Company. You would have radio equipment by Collins, radio equipment people from the United States. And one of the problems maintenance was having is trying to get all this information into their maintenance manuals and everything, and then train their maintenance people to work on this airplane. We got an Airbus, one of their first Airbuses that they produced, and they flew it to Miami, and they parked it in back of the maintenance hangar so nobody could see it except for the Eastern personnel, because Eastern didn't know whether they were going to buy this or not. And through really, really great financing, we did go ahead and purchase the A300. Unfortunately, when it went into the big checks and stuff, these different companies had produced a lot of redundant systems, and which ran up the maintenance cost on this airplane that was horrendous. Just for instance, we had these shutoff valves that if something ruptured the hydraulic system, they would shut it off so you wouldn't deplete the system out. Unfortunately, they did it for every system in the airplane, and then they would take sections. So you'd have like 56 of these little valves, and they never operated because the plane never had a malfunction. And so when they went into maintenance, you would have to operate these things individually. And I sat there for 3 days doing one airplane, nothing but doing these little valves off and on, off and on. So it was maintenance headaches plus a huge financial problem when we went into maintenance. Fortunately, Airbus became one of the premier airline building airplane companies in the world. In fact, they turn out a terrific product today, and it competes with Boeing and Lockheed when Lockheed was building their airplanes at the same time. So that's all I have about that.
Okay. We let's go with Jan's Regional Jet.
Okay, and I too am scaling down. The regional jet airliners are not a new concept in aviation. Aeroflot used the regional-sized mini jet airliners for decades when its airline functioned as a state-controlled national directive. Many of the post-World War II airliners were often used on short and economically significant prestige routes such as London to Paris or New York to Chicago by the world's major airlines. And then in the post-war era, many aircraft manufacturers sought to create a replacement aircraft for the DC-3, Douglas DC-3, which was surplus in large amounts after the war. First, there was a large 40 to 50 passenger size piston powered Convair 340 and Martin 202 and later a turboprop-powered aircraft like the Fokker F-27. In addition to that, due to the growing markets for feeder routes, in the 1970s, the market for smaller size mini airlines boomed with the process of route liberalization in the United States, known as airline deregulation. That was about 1978. And due to the growing markets for feeder routes, airlines and aircraft manufacturers rapidly replaced aircraft with larger amenity-equipped turboprop mini airlines, generally flown by regional-based smaller airlines to feed larger airline hub cities. So most of the U.S. flights are now on smaller jets. The smaller regional jets are really loved because they replace many of the turboprops, and they have multiplied into the majority of the domestic airline flights in the U.S.
Well, we have three more subjects, and I think because of time, we're going to carry this show over to next week, next Monday. So we've got a couple of other very interesting stories and subjects, rather, and we'll talk about that, discuss them. I think it's been very informative tonight. I do have one special request, Jim, for our listeners, and that is we urgently seek your support to keep this show on the air for another year. This may be our last one-hour show. Until we are able to support the one-hour format, all shows may, in the very near future, go to one-half hour. We sure would like to be with you longer than a half hour. That's not much time to keep the radio voice of Eastern as it has been over the last 2 years, 1 hour. Our major support was through one of the Eastern organizations in the past, but we're about out of funds to continue this very popular Eastern radio broadcast. Our average listeners for each show is a respectable 1,600 in over 40 countries around the world. And we need all the help we can get, folks. We want to remind you that you can donate to Pledge on our website of whatever you can afford. And you can go to EAL Radio Show. On the homepage, there's a donation button. You can click that, or either there's a location on Contact Us or About Us page that you can send a check and get an address. Margaret, you have something to say?
Well, Captain Neil, I just wanted to also make a personal appeal to our EAL listeners. You know, there's no other blog talk radio show on the air that is dedicated to keeping the Eastern Airlines memory alive as this show does. Captain Neil and all the hosts graciously give their time and their talent to try to make you laugh, even make you shed a tear once in a while, but most of all, to help you relive those glorious days when the best airline dominated the skies. So won't you please give what you can? Keep Eastern flying, if only in your hearts.
Margaret, this is Steve. You just reminded me that I'm behind in my donation, and I'm going, as soon as we hang up, I'm going to send a donation of $50 to this effort, because it is so special to me.
Great, Steve.
And I do think it's very important that we keep the Eastern voice alive and out to our listeners around the world. Jim, we're about to sign off. Would you take us out?
Yes, I will, Neil. Ladies and gentlemen, we're glad we could get together tonight, and thanks to our host for making an interesting conversation. To our hundreds of listeners around the world, we hope we can do it again next Monday at the same time and same place on your internet dial. Remember, we want to be with you for a full hour, so remember Neil's special request. Our sign-off bumper music tells me we're about out of time for this week's show. As you know, all of our radio shows go by episode numbers, and we're about to put number 109 broadcast into the radio archives, where you may listen again to this episode or any of the other 108 episodes during the past 2 years we've been broadcasting. Tell your friends about the show. More importantly, get involved with the rest of our hosts by participating in these broadcasts. You're welcome to participate live and on the air each Monday. We're proud of the fact that this show is the only airline company radio show of its kind. It's part of the way we're keeping the memory of Eastern Airlines alive. We are the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Well, that's all for tonight, and from all of your hosts, we say good night, Eastern family and friends.
Good night, Eastern family, and please support us.